Hello and welcome to the Anonymous Anthropologist Podcast with your host, the Anonymous Anthropologist. That's me. I am a community college professor of anthropology with more than 10 years of teaching in the classroom and a master's degree from Columbia University. I'd happily tell you more about me if only I could be sure that it wouldn't get me fired. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I am the Anonymous Anthropologist, here with you today to talk a little bit about government. I don't mean the government of the United States. I'm not going to talk about politics or current events today, but I mean government from an anthropological perspective. I'd like to try to answer the question, what is government for? There is a great divide today in America between people who believe the government should take care of folks and people who believe the government should do as little as possible. And I would just like to approach this from a historical and anthropological perspective. So I'm going to once again use the lens of what's called cultural materialism. It's a point of view that I take often when I'm trying to explain something to my students. And as I tell them, it's not the only way to analyze the world or to seek answers to questions, but it's a pretty good tool to get started in that search for information. So the theory of cultural materialism is pretty simple. It says that when you ask a question about a culture, you should seek answers or formulate your hypotheses around the facts of life as they are, the economy, the environment, and what people do in order to survive and make a living. So if a student asks me the question, what is government for? I have to reply with another question, which is, well, where are we talking about this government being, and what is the mode of production? What do people do for a living there? That's really crucial to begin to answer this question. So students of anthropology who follow this theory of cultural materialism know that we say that there are these five what are called modes of production, five ways predominantly of making a living that have existed around the world and throughout time. And of course, there's overlap, and people will do more than one of these at a time, but they do arise in a particular order, historically or prehistorically. So the five modes of production, I'm just going to lay them out for you first, and then we'll talk about them individually. The five modes of production are foraging, which means hunting and gathering, horticulture, which is when you raise crops using no technology, just your hands and a digging stick, pastoralism, which is when your economy relies on herding animals. That's herding, H-E-R-D-I-N-G, not hurting. Agriculture, when you use technology to grow as much food as possible. And finally, industrialism, when your mode of production revolves around the manufacture and sale of goods and services. From the beginning of humanity, from the dawn of the human age, and anthropologists think that we Homo sapiens have been around for about 200,000 years, so from the beginning, from our very first appearance on this planet in Africa, we were foragers, just like every other animal. Foraging is what animals do. They hunt and they gather. Lions hunt prey. Squirrels gather nuts. It's an animal strategy. For most of our existence on this planet, that's what we did. We hunted and gathered for about 190,000 years. It wasn't until 10, 15, maybe 20,000 years ago at most that we started using these other strategies of horticulture, pastoralism, agriculture, and industrialism. Inside these five major modes of production, there are what we could think of as four modes of government. You could split hairs here and subdivide into smaller units, but I'm just going to keep it simple and we'll stick with these four modes of government. And it's very traditional in the field, what we refer to them. It's a band, tribe, chiefdom, or state. So those are the four modes of government: band, tribe, chiefdom, and state. And since we've got five modes of production and only four modes of government, the modes of government kind of flow from one mode of production into the next. So, for example, if you are a forager or a horticulturalist, then you are most likely going to be in a band kind of government. That's B-A-N-D, band. Some horticulturalists will actually fall into more of a tribe, as will many pastoralists think of themselves as tribal people. Chiefdoms are really prominent with farmers or agriculturalists, but you sometimes find them with pastoralists. And then the state, you're only going to find a state society where people are practicing agriculture and or industrialism. So those are the four modes of government: band, tribe, chiefdom, and state. Okay, so how does this work? Well, if you are a forager, if you hunt and gather for a living, then certain things are absolutely prescribed about your life. For one thing, you're going to live in a very small group because you are completely dependent upon the resources around you to support you. If your group grows too large, then you will have to split up and some of you will have to find another place to find food. Otherwise, you will rapidly deplete the resources. So foraging groups are typically pretty small, usually maybe in the dozens. Foragers are 100% in charge of meeting their own needs, individually and as a group. They have no one external to themselves and their kin to provide for them. Every adult gets up every morning and goes about the business of acquiring food to feed their family that day. The husband will take the grown boys, the woman will take the small children, and they will go off in their different directions doing their different assigned tasks, and they will come back together sometime later in the day, bringing back whatever they have managed to collect or catch. They have what we think of as a direct entitlement to the basic necessities of life, and that's food, shelter, and clothing. That's what we need in order to survive, right? Food, shelter, and clothing. And people who live in a foraging society are able to provide their own food, shelter, and clothing. If they are hungry, they will catch a fish. If they need a place to live, they will build a shelter. If they need clothing, they will skin an animal and sew clothing. Or they will produce a textile. They are responsible for seeing to their own needs. There is nothing standing between them and the basic necessities of life. They have these direct entitlements. So then, what need is there of government? And the answer is there is no need of government. Why would there be? There is no property to protect. Nobody owns anything. When you are a forager, you move around quite a lot, and so you don't acquire things. The group is small enough to usually make decisions by consensus to maintain their own behavioral standards. There's just no need of any kind of formal government, so they're loosely organized into what is called a band. And a band has no formal leader. There's no one in charge. There doesn't have to be. Bands use what we can think of as a sort of situational leadership, which means that the leader is chosen based upon the task. So when it's time to go out on a hunt, the person who was the most successful hunter will lead the hunters. When it's time to go look for water, the person who's best at doing that will lead that. When it's time to negotiate with neighbors, the best negotiator will do that. So there is no formal leadership. It is a society of equals. Now, as groups become larger, this becomes more difficult to maintain. And typically, groups will start to grow when they start providing their own food, when they start growing their own food or raising animals, because as long as you are in a foraging mode of production, your group can only get so large. But sometime between 10 and 20,000 years ago, human beings started raising animals and growing our own food, and that was a major shift in human society, the shift from gathering food to producing food. That's really a giant step, human beings taking charge of their lives in a very big way. Where people lived, where there was fertile land, they began practicing horticulture. And horticulture is very simple. The rule about horticulture is there's no technology, there's no animal labor, there's no machine labor, there's no fertilization, there's no crop rotation, there's nothing like that. There's just you and a digging stick and rain. Horticulture is very, very dependent on the environment. If it stops raining, your horticulture will no longer be successful. If you figure out how to do irrigation, well, then you're into what we can call agriculture, which is a lot more sophisticated. It produces a lot more food and leads to a really different kind of society. But if we stick just now with the horticulturalists, then we know that horticultural societies can grow quite a bit larger than foraging societies because you are producing food, and so it is possible to have more children and support them. And when your society is fairly small, it hangs together pretty well under that band organization. But eventually it starts to grow and becomes a little bit more complex, and then you start to think that maybe you might need a little bit more formal leadership. This is especially the case if you have neighbors with whom you have to negotiate to avoid warfare. You might be conducting marriages between groups, for example, and it really does help to have a sort of formal headman or headwoman in place to make sure that everything goes as it is supposed to. In these types of societies, the way that you become the big man or the headman is by being incredibly popular, because it is basically a consensus decision. The way that you know that you are the leader is if people are following you. And if they decide you're not doing a good job, they will stop following you. Being the big man or the head man might seem like a job with a lot of perks, but the truth is, actually, it involves a lot of sacrifice. Because one of the core values of these types of societies, both foraging and horticultural societies, one of the core values is generosity and sharing. And that's because you are very dependent upon the climate, the rainfall, the crops, the animals moving through. And so there are going to be times of scarcity when people are going hungry. Especially in the foraging mode of production, you may go out one day and come back empty-handed. And when you get back to your settlement, your kinfolk are not going to let you starve. They're going to share what they have with you. And part of that is because of what we think of as reciprocity, which is give and take. And so they will share with you because they know, of course, being kinfolk, that one day they will come back empty-handed and you will share what you have with them. So sharing and generosity is a core value. In horticultural societies like the Yanomamo of Venezuela, this is one of those classic cultures that anthropology students study, the Yanomamo of Venezuela. They have a terrific value placed upon generosity. And if you've seen the very, very famous ethnographic films of Napoleon Chagnon, then you see these scenes where he and his friend are going back and forth about who is the more generous person. Chagnon explains to the viewer that the only way to get to the Yanomami version of hell is by being stingy. These are people, by the way, that Chagnon refers to as fierce. And he thinks of them as really rather brutal. They're very violent in his eyes, a very violent society. But nonetheless, he does recognize that their core value, like most other horticultural people and foraging people, is generosity. Generosity and sharing is absolutely necessary for the survival of the group as a whole. So that's how you get to be big man or head man, is by giving stuff away. The person who gives the most stuff away is going to be the most respected, the most honored, and generally the most followed. So that's how you become head man or big man. It's usually through charisma and generosity. Sometimes the job of head man or big man actually is really rather dangerous, because it puts you into a position where you represent your people group, and so that makes you a target for your enemies. The position of headman is not very desirable, because oftentimes it's the headman who will be sent out to meet with or negotiate with people in other villages, and he may well be murdered along the way. So not a lot of perks to that position. What the headman or the big man does really is just provide a sort of figurehead in terms of relationships with outside groups. They also function as a sort of mediator between people within the culture. So if there's a conflict, they may well go to the big man or the headman for advice or mediation. But other than that, the role has no real power. Because again, the people have direct entitlements. They provide for themselves food, shelter, and clothing, and they really have no need of government. So you see this with horticulturalists and sometimes with pastoralists. Pastoralists who live in small groups will often be organized along this sort of tribal pattern. What is pastoralism? Pastoralism is about herding animals, H-E-R-D-I-N-G, herding animals. And generally speaking, we're talking about animals that give milk, because it's really quite a luxury to raise animals that don't give milk, because they eat a lot of food. They eat food you could eat. It takes quite an investment to feed them for quite a while, and then you only get so many meals out of the beast when you kill it. But a cow or a camel or a reindeer will give milk until it dies. So most herding people live upon the milk primarily of their animals, and they only eat the meat on special occasions. The Maasai are traditionally a cattle herding people, and they are known to love and decorate their cattle. And the Maasai say when a man's cow dies, his heart is broken, but his belly is happy. So they typically prefer to keep their animals alive. Herding people will take these animals to pasture, and that is why they're called pastoralists. Since people who herd animals have to feed their animals, and usually those animals who produce milk are grass eaters, the people have to take the animals where the grass is, to the fresh pastures. So they are constantly on the move. So a phrase you often hear is nomadic pastoralists. Nomadic pastoralists. Those two words almost always go together because you have to take the animals to wherever the grass is. Pastoralist groups can be small enough to be organized into that tribal sort of organization, but they can grow very large. If the climate is good and the pasture is good, then herds can grow very, very large. And as herds grow larger, communities tend to grow because there's more food to support more people. Once again, to return to the example of the Maasai, primarily because they are so really thoroughly researched, the traditional Maasai culture allows a man to marry as many wives as he can afford to support, and that means as many cows as he has, as much cattle as he holds. Because every time he gets married, he has to give his new wife, I think it's 8 head of cattle, and they form the herd that will eventually be passed on to the sons that he has with her. So if he's going to take more than one wife, he needs at least 8 more cows. So cattle are an index of wealth, and they also give you an idea of how many wives a man might be able to take. When a society practices polygyny, which is when one man will take more than one wife, that is a recipe for population increase, because one man can have 3 wives and have 3 babies at the same time, right? So populations grow when there is polygyny. So sometimes pastoral groups can get very, very large. It's also the case that pastoral groups can sometimes be very aggressive. Because they are moving around so much with their animals, it's often the case that they trespass on the land of neighbors who don't want them there, and so this creates antagonism and leads to violence. The Maasai induct all their young men into a state of warriorhood when they're teenagers, and they learn to be warriors and go out in the field and defend the cattle from hyena. And it used to be the case that they learned how to raid cattle from their neighbors, but that's no longer allowed. But still, the category of warrior, it's a life cycle stage with the Maasai. It's something every young man goes through, warriorhood, and it's directly related to the Maasai history and prehistory of cattle raiding, which is, you know, fairly common among pastoralists. They believe the animals belong to them, and when they see the animals with someone else, they assume they've been stolen. There is actually a Maasai story, a Maasai myth. Oh, calling it a myth makes it sound like it's not true. Myth is just the anthropology word for sacred story. And usually, if it's your sacred story, then you know it's true. So there is an ancient Maasai myth which says that the god of the Maasai gave all the cattle in the world to the Maasai. So wherever they see cattle that they don't possess, they believe they have been stolen and would seek to regain them. So we've talked so far about the band and the tribe, and now we get to the chiefdom. If a pastoralist society is large enough, it may indeed become a chiefdom, but chiefdoms are really associated with farming societies. And the thing about farming is it changes everything. You see, when you're a forager, you know what you're going to do when you get up in the morning. You're going to go out and hunt and gather. That's what you're going to do. And when you're a horticulturalist, you're going to be in your garden all day, taking care of your crops, making sure you can feed your people. And when you're a pastoralist, you're going to be with your animals. You're going to be managing them and their products, their milk and their fur or hides or whatever it is. That's what you're going to be doing. But when you begin farming in a full-on agricultural mode of production, oh, you know, then all of a sudden that certainty about what you're going to do with your day, it changes. Because, well, let's face it, we live in an agricultural society. Somebody's growing food, right? But are you? How many of you listening are farmers? Very few, I imagine. See, the thing about the agricultural mode of production is that not everybody has to do it. It's amazing. It frees human beings from having to provide for their own food all the time, having to grow it themselves. And it leads to what we talk about as specialization, the idea that there are different jobs that different people can do. If you are a forager or a horticulturalist or a pastoralist, that's what you are, that's your job. But if you live in a farming economy, well, you could be a farmer, but you could also be the person who shoes the horses or makes the barrels or makes shoes, or builds houses, or transports grain. There are all these other jobs that have to be done in a farming economy, and so it leads to what's called specialization. Now, typically, if we look back through the lens of archaeology at ancient cities, what happens when people get into large-scale agriculture is the society tends to get divvied up into farmland and urban land. And this is true in ancient Egypt. It's true in ancient Persia. It's true everywhere you look. Ancient China. The farmland is rural, and this is where the crops are raised. But then there's a whole class of urban laborers that work at some distance from the farm in the city. See, agriculture gives rise to cities because, again, it makes it possible for people to not have to grow food. So they get to do all other kinds of things. Think back to the ancient Egyptians, to the pharaoh. The pharaoh's primary job was to make sure that there was enough grain to feed the laborers. That was his number one worry. And it was so important that there be enough grain to feed the laborers and that be properly accounted for, that there's actually one ancient accountant to the pharaoh, I believe, who has his own tomb. I remember seeing that in one of those National Geographic specials with Mr. Zahi Hawass. He's the Egyptian guy who does all their archaeology, and he's in every National Geographic special. And they did an excavation of a tomb which belonged to an accountant, essentially. He was such an important man to the pharaoh. So now that we're in this agricultural mode of production, we're entering the chiefdom. That's usually going to be a chiefdom. And a chiefdom is really different from a band or a tribe because there really is formal leadership in a chiefdom. There has to be. Now, in a chiefdom, the leader is a chief. Obviously, what color is George Washington's white horse, right? The leader of a chiefdom is a chief. And the reason that the chief is the leader is because he is the son of the last chief, generally speaking. It's an inherited role. It becomes very, very important in an agricultural mode of production to have an inherited form of leadership. And this gets to the nut of the question right here as to what is government for? Feeding the people. Because what happens in that agricultural society is you've got the farmers on the farm and everybody else in the city, and the very first problem is how to get the food from the farm to the city. Who's going to do that? How's that going to happen? There needs to be roads and infrastructure and accounting and vessels and you name it. This is a tremendous undertaking of organization, and you have to have a government to do it. So in the cultural materialist point of view, the primary purpose of formal government is to get the food from the farm to the city. It's to feed people. And secondary to that is to put the mechanisms in place that make that possible. Because what happens when you start farming is, sure, it frees you up to not farm, to be a specialist, to be a doctor or a lawyer or something else. But all of a sudden, you've lost your direct entitlements, haven't you? You no longer have direct access to food. No, you have to go through a whole bunch of hoops to get that food. You have to get an education so you can get a job, so you can make a living, so you can get paid, so you can buy food. And how are you going to buy the food if it's not sitting there when you go to the supermarket or the market or the farmer's market? Or how, you know, somebody has to get that food there for you because you're not going to the farm to get it generally. So the primary purpose of government is to move that food along. That was so important in ancient Egypt that there's a tomb dedicated to the accountant who oversaw the granary at one point to make sure that that food was being grown in enough quantity to feed the workers, to feed the people. Agriculture, as I said before, changes everything because it's always getting bigger. It's always expanding. See, look at it this way. Let's say you have an original group of 100 people, 50 couples, man and woman, and they have so much land. And they're raising a lot of food and they're able to feed themselves. So instead of having only two children, which we would call replacement level reproduction, they go ahead and have four children because there's so much food to feed them. And in the next generation, they have twice as many people, but they still only have the same amount of land. So how are they going to feed themselves? Well, they'll probably intensify their production, irrigation, crop rotation, something like that. And if they meet with success, they'll have even more children. As a matter of fact, farmers tend to have very, very large families. If I meet someone who says they come from a family of 10 or 12 kids, my next question is, were you guys farmers? And Oftentimes I'm correct. Sometimes it's a Catholic family because observant Catholics don't practice birth control. But historically and prehistorically, farming families are the largest families there are. And that's because children work in a farming family. Their labor is necessary. And also there happens to be enough food to feed them. So farming families grow very, very large. Well, now you have this expanding community, this expanding population, and yet your land resources are fixed. Well, that's a problem. And so what do people do about that problem? What do you do when you have too many people and not enough land? Well, you all know the answer to that, right? You conquer your neighbors. And if there aren't very many people, then you might incorporate them into your society, largely through the institution of slavery. If there are a lot of people, well, you certainly don't want to have to feed them, right? You just want their land to feed yourselves. So you just exterminate them. This is an ugly truth about history and prehistory, is this human expansion. As populations grow in one place and their food resources become limited, they expand into the next place. And if there are people already there, there's often violence and conflict and death. Now, leaving that aside for the moment, we have to recognize that what this does is it diversifies the culture. Now, in those previous modes of production, everybody in the group is kin. You're all related. You may be distant cousins, but you're all related. Well, once you start conquering neighbors and expanding, now you have people in your society to whom you are not related. People who may not speak the same language or practice the same religion. And why would they recognize your chief as a leader if he's their conqueror? The leader needs a little bit more power than just this consensus of people following him. He needs his power to be a little bit more formalized. And let's face it, when he marches into your province with his army, that's a fairly formalized form of power. So what happens in these larger scale agricultural societies is we enter the state. Because once you're raising an army with the purpose of conquering your neighbors, you can be called a state society. And a state society is very different from a band, a tribe, or a chiefdom, because it is multicultural, multi-ethnic. It is composed of people from lots of different places because state societies, agricultural societies, are constantly expanding. Expanding makes them inclusive, and their leadership has to be formalized. Now here we are in our industrial mode of production. Of course, industrialism would not be possible without an agricultural base. We can't do all this manufacturing, provide all these social services, unless there's somebody growing food to feed us, correct? So there are agriculturalists somewhere growing food. In the United States, they tend to be these large corporate farms. As governments move from an agricultural to an industrialized mode of production, the form of government has to shift a little bit. In a chiefdom, people respect the chief because he is the son of the last chief. He has the strongest ties to the most important ancestor. And because you're kin, your cousins, you respect that to some degree. But in a state, there has to be some other way to hold the people together because there are so many groups that are unrelated to each other. So the power of the chief has to transform a little bit when the society becomes more like a state. If your chief conquers my people and takes us in, how is he going to get us to respect his authority aside from, you know, at the point of the bow and arrow? Well, if we look into prehistory, we can see that often the step that they take is to become divine kings. They proclaim themselves as gods. And so if my chief is not just a chief, but actually a god, well, then he has reign over you as well, doesn't he? And once again, if he's facing you down with an arrow and he has the power of life and death over you, then for all intents and purposes, he is a god. He might as well be. And so you'll see these divine kings. This is true of the Pharaoh, the Aztec king, the Inca. You see these divine kings throughout prehistoric societies. And their divinity is often conveyed to the people in the form of what's called monumental architecture. They build these tremendous structures which are just overwhelming to horticultural and foraging people and pastoral people who are nomadic and typically build nothing to last. Well, their societies get taken over by chiefdoms and later state societies, and they walk through the gates. They walk through the gates of Babylon, and they see these amazing structures, and they're overwhelmed by the force and magnitude of that god and that leader. Surely he must be a god. So when the chiefdom becomes a state, oftentimes the chief becomes a divine king. Now, you'll see state societies with agricultural societies, of course, but they're also associated with industrial societies. But the leader of an industrial state is not usually a divine king. industrialism is based on manufacturing. Manufacturing is based on scientific principles. It's also dependent upon capitalism, which has its own principles. And so divinity becomes far less important. Since state societies are also found in industrial societies, we also see the rise of democracy. I actually feel very strongly that democracy is a product of capitalism. Although I'm not a fan of capitalism's ill effects, I do believe that the power of the purse is the strongest power there is, and that what gives people the idea that they have a right to anything is money in their pocket. I think that as people became able to have agency in their lives, to make choices for themselves, to specialize in whatever they chose, and to be able to go out there and make money, money is power, and then they want to vote. Then they want to have something to do with their government, and they've got the money, so they make it happen. This is also can go on and on and in a lot of different directions, but I'm just trying to make a simple point here today, and that is to return to the question of what is government for? So according to this model that I've laid out, government as we know it really doesn't arise until you get to that agricultural mode of production, when all of a sudden it becomes necessary to provide infrastructure to make sure that people get fed, to make sure that people get what they need, their entitlements. If we're foraging, we have direct entitlements to food, shelter, and clothing, and we don't need anybody to take care of us. This is true, too, of horticulture and pastoralism. But when we enter that agricultural mode of production, and later on the industrial mode of production, we lose our direct entitlements. They become indirect entitlements. And all of a sudden, there's a whole host of things that stand in between us and the things we need to live: food, shelter, and clothing. That's why we have government. To make sure that we get what we need, that the food is in the store when we go there, that we have jobs so that we can pay for food, that there's clothing in the store that we can buy to put on our backs to go to work, and that we have jobs to pay for that too. So you see how the whole thing spirals together. It's really pretty straightforward. In industrial and agricultural modes of production, we have no ability to provide the basic necessities of life for ourselves. We're completely dependent upon a system that is way beyond our individual selves to make sure that the basic necessities are there for us when we need them. And that's why it matters what government does. Because government is responsible for making these connections that get lost as soon as we become agricultural and industrial societies. That's why government arises in the first place. Otherwise, why do we need it? I mean, a lot of people think government exists essentially to protect our private property. And I think that's born of our capitalist democracy that we have here. I think when America was founded, that was a lot of it. We wanted the ability to grow wealthy and protect our wealth. In England, you had to inherit your wealth by and large, but in America, you could make it yourself. But from an anthropological point of view, from a historical and cross-cultural point of view, the kind of government that we expect in the United States, this democracy, this representative form of government, exists and arises specifically to provide for the needs of the people. So that's my answer to you, Mr. Grover Norquist. You're famous for your statement that you'd like to see government made small enough that you could drown it in a bathtub. Oh, Mr. Norquist, I'm sure a lot of people would like to drown you in a bathtub. But government, my friend, we need that. Unless you'd like to go back to hunting and gathering. Well, that's all I have for you today. I'd like to thank you all for listening, for hanging in there as these podcasts get further and further apart. I do apologize for that, but I have had a set of other responsibilities kick in recently. My first few podcasts were done during a period of downtime, but now I'm back at it, so I apologize for the delay. I will do my best to keep up for you all. I invite you to write to me at theanonymousanthropologist@gmail.com. That's theanonymousanthropologist@gmail.com. I have temporarily discontinued the voicemail. It was really not getting any calls at all, I'm sorry to say. People seem to like email a lot better, so let's just keep that going. theanonymousanthropologist@gmail.com. Please like me on the Facebook page so I can keep up with that. Love to hear from you. Always enjoy getting your questions and your comments, and love to reply to you. Keep listening. Till next time, take care.